Well, good afternoon. I'm happy to be here to speak a little bit about Mexican migrants. There are Mexican migrants in Montana. Even folks in my community don't know this, so it's interesting. I'll begin by saying I have no relationships to disclose. And I appreciate the opportunity to share my work in partnership with Mexican migrant families. Montana offers a new frontier for Mexican migration, and if you've never traveled to Montana, you might not know that we are the fourth largest state in the Union with less than 1 million people. So that's about 6 square miles of elbow room per person. Between 2000 and 2010, we saw a 68% growth in the Latino population statewide, and Gallatin Valley, which is the home of Montana State University, saw 125% growth. The valley is home to Bozeman, Montana, which is currently the fourth largest state in Montana with less than 40,000 people. So to give you a little perspective, the biggest city in Montana is Billings, with 106,000, and the 10th largest city in Montana is Whitefish, with 8,400 people. So it's quite small. Migrants come to Montana in search of work and also for a quiet, safe, nice, beautiful place to live. Such frontier spaces, however, offer distinctively challenging context for migrants. There's limited employment, especially for women. There's a weak social service base. Mexican migrants stand out amongst a majority white population. They face a hostile culture of nativism. It's estimated that we have fewer than 5,000 undocumented migrants in the state, yet this last legislative session, there were 20 anti-immigrant bills introduced into the legislature. With such large geographic expanses, driving is a must, and we have heard many, many stories of perceived racial profiling by police, and we have a significant ICE presence in the valley. Perhaps not surprising, Mexican migrants in the general literature have been found to suffer from high rates of depression, with women experiencing a larger share of the burden. However, the bulk of that research resides in urban, well-established migrant hubs, and we suspect that migrants in rural new destinations are demographically different. They're more likely to be poor, less educated, less literate, to come from rural areas, and to maintain traditional gender roles within the family. So our research is to try to shed light on some of these unique variables. In order to do this work, we're using a community-based participatory action research approach. Given the significant marginalization and vulnerability of this community, it's critical that we establish trusting relationships. And this approach also attempts to redistribute power and works in a cooperative way to build capacity to empower communities and to act to promote social justice and improved health outcomes. We have a number of collaborators working together on this project. Most importantly is our community advisory board. It's made up of 5 Mexican migrants, the research team, and several health practitioners and outreach workers. And in my free time, I'm the president of the Gallatin Valley Human Rights Task Force, and I sit on the board of the Montana Human Rights Network. And it was the human rights community that first began hearing stories of migrant injustice and troubles accessing services regardless of documentation status. So this research is born out of the community's call for help. And it started back in 2006 with my colleague, Dr. Lear Schmalzbauer, who began conducting ethnographic interviews with community members. That led to the formation of our community advisory board and a needs assessment survey, and most recently we've conducted a mental health survey. So our early findings suggest a very gendered context for migrants to Montana. As Miguel says, well, for women it's very difficult because being at home all the time is like being in prison, no? They don't have anywhere to go out. For us men, we go out to work, one gets distracted. But for women, no, they are imprisoned and they don't know anyone. And Roberta sort of echoes this, well, I hardly have any friends, I almost never leave, I am almost always in the house with the kids, the only time I leave is to buy food. It's a very dangerous environment for women to travel by car in order to access even groceries. Franco also talks about fear. I'm totally responsible for my family. If I don't work, we don't eat. There are arrests all the time in the canyon. And people have to traverse a canyon, a two-lane road, to get to one of the most populous migrant work areas. It's fairly isolated, and so police and ICE will just traverse this canyon all day long, profiling, stopping, and deporting people. And it can happen very, very quickly. As Franco says, I'm not afraid for myself, I'm afraid for my family. My wife is pregnant every day. I have to wonder if I'll be arrested and deported, and then what will they do? And lastly, Sylvia asserts, fear is the worst thing about living here. I'm constantly looking over my shoulder at Walmart, at the clinic, everywhere. We stand out. I'm never at ease. My brother was deported from here, and I can't let them separate me from my kids. So, not surprisingly, perhaps migrants' experiences of fear and isolation may result in depression. When we looked originally at rates of depression, 54% of the men in the original sample, the first study, and 40% of the women scored in the range for clinical concern. This is contrary to the extant literature in that men were experiencing a higher share of the burden. Of interest to me as a family scientist were the emergent patterns of depression by family configuration. Single men and married men in Montana without their partners were more depressed than married men accompanied by their spouses. And residing with your spouse did not appear to buffer women from depression symptoms in the way that it appears to buffer married men. So I said this was action research as well, and there's really been a give and take, research and action. As we learned of the needs of the community, we launched Know Your Rights forums and legal clinics. We've provided English language classes, computer literacy classes. We've lobbied the legislature, done a lot of educational outreach. And legal issues in particular are significant in Montana, yet I also want to say that there are only three immigration attorneys in the entire state that I'm aware of, and we work very closely with two of them that are actively taking cases related to deportation issues. They often live hours away from folks needing their services. And we've also offered this program called Tios and Tios. It's kind of a fun, exciting program that evolved between the Community Advisory Board and students at the university wanting to do a service learning project, and they do a student-child mentoring, and it's led by the students. So in phase two, we conducted the mental health survey, and perhaps because we were successful in establishing trust with community members, this round we were able to ask about documentation status, and clearly status matters for depression. Undocumented migrants were significantly more depressed than their documented counterparts, but the gender and family configuration patterns also emerged here in the data. In this sample, we had more single women, and they reported more depression symptoms than any other group, consistent with the literature. Married men here with their spouses continued to report fewer symptoms, with married documented women reporting the fewest symptoms of all groups. Best predictors of depression included negative coping, self-blame, giving up, financial insecurity, fearfulness, and sending remittances home. Isolation and family configuration reached trends in the data, and this model accounted for 50% of the variance in depression scores. You'll notice that religious involvement was not significant in the model, but when we control for a host of variables, it appears that religious involvement is pretty important as a way of decreasing depression experiences. So in sum, our preliminary work suggests that migration to frontier places is gendered in unique, perhaps unique ways. Families tend to be more traditional in orientation, and women have few opportunities for employment, perhaps limiting their opportunities, and for some, limiting their economic liberation. Documentation status, family configuration, and gender all matter for depression, and I hope we continue to look at these variables together so we don't miss some of these the intricacies there of family and how it matters and plays out. Religious involvement may be an important factor in increasing positive coping, decreasing isolation and fear, increasing social support and solidarity. We do a lot of community organizing through the church. It's the safest place that migrants have in our community. And in conclusion, our next steps, we are launching a study right now to examine cultural and contextual models of mental health to determine really what the meanings of all of this is for the people, and then how might we best intervene, particularly when we have few Spanish-speaking clinicians and physicians. We really don't have many modalities in which to provide care and services, so I'm wondering how we can perhaps develop a promotora program, the ways in which we can help each other the best we can as a community. We'll continue to do legal and health forums and move forward. Thank you very much.